Before we begin, I want to encourage you to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic to make a pledge in support of this show and sign up for the feed there, which will be ad-free forever. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 94 is Ian Moore, whom I was very familiar with from back in the day when he was a prominent Stevie Ray Vaughan sort of figure in Austin, where I was living at the time. You're right now listening to Satisfied from the album Ian Moore, 1993. Well, he's now recorded 10 studio albums, 3 live albums, and 3 EPs. He's moved to the Seattle area. He teaches songwriting classes and has gone through many stylistic changes. We're going to be talking about 1,000 Blackbirds from his most recent EP, 2018's Toronto. Then looking to Strange Days from the 2017 album of that name. Then looking back to Abilene from 2004's Luminaria. And we'll conclude by listening to Sad Affair from 2011's El Sonido Nuevo. For more information, please see ianmoore.com. And for more about this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Built by musicians, BandZoogle is an all-in-one platform that makes it easy to build a beautiful website for your music. BandZoogle powers the websites for tens of thousands of musicians around the world, from weekend warriors to Grammy winners. All the features you need for a professional website are already built in. You'll get hosting and a custom domain name, dozens of fully customizable design templates, tools to sell your music and merch commission-free, mailing list tools to grow your fan list and send newsletters, social media integrations, and live support from BandZoogle's musician-friendly team at 7 days a week. Nakedly Examined Music podcast listeners can go to BandZoogle.com to try it free for 30 days and use the promo code NEM to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. Again, that's BandZoogle.com, promo code NEM. So I will have played a little bit of Satisfied as your biggest hit from your first album, 1993. There's been a lot of miles between that and what we're about to hear, 1,000 Blackbirds from your recent EP, Toronto. Do you want to say a little about that journey before we hear the full song?
I mean, I think that's part of what's wonderful about songwriting is that there's no one place that you're at. I'm a big fan of music. A lot of my friends and the people that I look to, it is a journey. It's getting into different scenes, you know, changing the way you look at writing in general. And there were a lot of years, a lot of miles, a lot of shows, a lot of bands between those two songs. And 1,000 Blackbirds was also a very different emotional place for me. You know, I'm married. I have 2 kids. I've got a very different perspective on life than I did when I was 22, hopefully. And I think the change in my songwriting and my music reflects that.
All right. Well, give us a little intro to what you were doing with this Toronto EP and that song in particular.
Well, the Toronto EP was something that came about when a friend of mine up in Toronto contacted me about making a record together. And like a lot of other songwriters, I have a decent stockpile of songs, some of which hadn't seen the light. And then a number of songs I was working on at the time. And so what I did was I kind of crafted what I feel like is a cohesive set of material, you know, that's kind of rock leaning, but hopefully smart and terse. 1,000 Blackbirds actually came out after there was a news story where there were a bunch of birds that fell from the sky on New Year's Day. And of course, there were all these apocalyptic. There were a lot of folks that were making this into this big end of days scenario. So that was pretty much the kind of humorous liftoff for the song. Doomsayers are the lucky ones. They'll celebrate the end of days. They won't be lonely when the rapture comes. Still they sit in the dark, taking shots at their enemies. Don't let the burden fall on common sense. Just take your winnings and invest before you
terrible scene, hanging on to this teenage dream. 1,000 blackbirds falling down. They say I'm a
man, I really like just how driving this song is and the way the chord progression just carries through, especially this little turnaround at the end of the first verse. You're in B flat the whole time. And it, actually, even just that initial, like, what key are we in at the beginning? Because going from that B flat to the G, both being major, like, well, we've already done a key change in the first line, and it just keeps barreling through.
To me, not that it's directly this, but that's a very stiff records kind of thing. A lot of bands in the early 80s were, that's a very jarring going from a B flat to a G sharp. It's like you immediately go from the root to your third is a half step up. So it's short of a minor second. It's about as jarring of a second chord as you can have. And it's not really a correct songwriting chord, which is why I like it. Typically, if you were writing a song and somebody was following the rules of songwriting, you'd play a G minor, right? Because it's the relative minor B flat. So to start off that, you're pretty much setting the tone right off the bat that it's going to be edgy and probably kind of pissed off.
Yeah, the actual turnaround leaves that altogether. Coming up with these kind of progressions, usually the way is just put your hands on the guitar in various places and see what propels you forward. But do you want to say anything about what your approach is to writing this kind of thing? I mean, was this a lyrics first? Was this a chords first? Was this more or less at the same time?
To me, the song, first of all, is about a relationship. And the end of days being kind of like the way you can look at a relationship, either you're in it or you're out it. If you see things as always being, you know, the end days and things aren't going to work out, you know, you have a lack of faith in the future, right? That pretty much dictated the gist of the song. It's an angry song and it's edgy because there's that angst of like feeling that somebody's not going to give something a chance. What I like to do in a thing like that is I like to take, if I'm feeling kind of a personal anger, I like to maybe switch the narrative. So what I did is looked at it like literally somebody that was kind of an end of days, you know, doomsayer talking about how the world's going to stop instead of it being somebody talking about love, because it's kind of the same thing. I thought it was a fun little joust around a corner to make a point.
Just looking at the progression of the lyrics through, you set up the doomsayer at the beginning, and then you're quickly talking about what is potentially the comment on yourself here. We don't have to literally go through the how much we want to analyze this line by line or anything, but you say, I'm a stain on the new year. I'll tell you that I let you down. You're just focusing on the perceived failings or difficulties of a relationship as compared to Armageddon.
Yeah, the verses are that, and the chorus basically goes back to an interpersonal dynamic. To me, that's the fun kind of tennis game of songwriting where you go far afield in the verse to the point where it's like, what the hell are you even talking about? And then when you come to your chorus, that's a really, really, I mean, it's to me, this is kind of songwriting 101, at least the type of songs that I like oftentimes are, you know, you really can create whatever you want in the verses and you can have all this symbolism and stuff. But ultimately, I'm a pop guy and I want a chorus to be a sing-along and I want a chorus to make a really, really solid point. That's the Beach Boys fan in me, the Beatles fan in me. That's the 50s and 60s pop fan that where, you know, it's a sing-along part. And then the verses in this song in particular, they're pretty heady. And then the other thing that I did in this song that I love to do is I love a double entendre, or actually a true play on words. The end of the bridge is being burnt by the sun. And of course, sun is S-O-N, which is burnt by the Son of God because you've been played.
I was going to ask you about that, but I didn't want to, like, if it was just a typo.
That's one of my favorite things to do. And, you know, I do that a lot up here living on the Puget Sound. I mean, I probably put that in five songs. I love the sound of the sound, you know, or the, you know, the sun and the sun. And that right there is the total apex of the whole song, which is to say that all these doomsayers are completely full of it. And, you know, they're missing the whole point. And then you can connect that to the narrative about love too. It's like, as soon as you have that thing in your eyes and you're not looking for the ability to work things out, you pretty much screwed any opportunity for success.
Yeah. And it's funny, since the song is so fast, this is all just really barreling by. And I mean, what you just described, there's no way that anybody either not discussing it with you or looking at a lyric sheet at least is going to get that that's that double meaning. Certainly in a live setting, you know, I found this a lot and in fact have started playing more acoustically with a smaller group, because if you write very lyric oriented songs, especially live, but even here, since the song is so blazing, like it just goes past. You have to rely on the fact that this is a medium that's meant to be played over and over again and kind of internalized and not just experienced as a one-off feeling, which I think is maybe says something about what my understanding of your music was with your first album, because I lived in Austin at that time. I was a firsthand witness to that scene and really what a pop song is about and why pop songs are supposed to be poppy. People are supposed to get them immediately. And well, you do have the hook here, but the hook is just to, again, hook you in. It's not actually, like, it requires way more than merely experiencing this once to get even what you're talking about.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm a big Andy Kaufman fan, and you don't need to tell people what you're really doing, you know. I think that this song, as a matter of fact, I haven't really played that one a lot live, but a lot of people really like it. And, you know, they like it because they like the attitude of it, and they like the hook of the song. You know, 1,000 blackbirds falling down. It's a good hook. So they don't need to know. And then I feel like it's kind of like movies in the 70s. You know how like even the 80s where you watch a movie like maybe you think would be, I should say I do. I have a great parenting story that would fit perfectly on this interview. I had my kids and a couple other friends' kids, and my wife and her friend had gone out to go have some wine. And I was trying to put on a movie. And so in my brain, the perfect movie with this cross-section of people was Caddyshack, which, of course, then watching it was like, oh, God, what, you know, what kind of father am I? The point being that a lot of great movies, especially around that time, had multi-layers. They had the layers for the kids, they had the layers for the parents, and they had a couple of little, like, real nuggets for the weirdos in the room that wanted to grab onto something deeper. And I don't think that songs need to be monochromatic. Matter of fact, I would say that my favorite kind of songs are the kind of songs where you can love it and you can think it's just a killer song. And if you actually listen to the words, you realize, wow, there's something being said here. And, you know, if you need that depth of purpose to make your soul feel all right, it's there.
I'm just trying to think about how the lyrics relate here to the mood. This is a joyful song, but there are a lot of dark elements in it. And it just, it's plowing through, you know, it's just relying, especially before you get to the chorus, just on power and speed, you know, not overwhelming. It's not a thrash song, but like, of the muscular kind of rock song. And, you know, you're talking about doomsayers and things. So it's a kind of joy, but it's kind of joy like that is slightly manic and uncontrolled, right? It's a joy in spite of the negative elements or even because of them.
To me, I mean, not that it sounds like a Graham Parker song, but
it
feels like a Graham Parker song to me. That would be kind of the thing. My touchstone as a music fan, if somebody would be like, well, you know, what were you thinking? I'd be like, well, Graham Parker had that way of that, you know, and it was different than like the way Elvis Costello did it. Like he would just, his words were like acidic. He had this really great way of just spitting them out of his mouth, and he could sing really fast, and you'd hear lots of P's and T's and S's. So even the phonetics of it were purposeful, you know?
Just a couple of the transitions I want to call attention to. I think the bridge. Yeah, so just even that descending, which is a dominant minor scale, I see, but like the last two notes, it doesn't jump all the way to the G until you start the bridge. And it's two different guitars, right? It's boom-ba, 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 so that you've set up this little fast, raggedy stereo thing to set up the next section, which I'm not sure if there's a name for that rhythm, that do-do-ta-ta, do-do, that double time.
Two things. Number one, that two guitar thing was us trying to create an automatopoeia kind of thing of like birds falling out of the sky, like button, 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 but just kind of, you know, within the context and the rhythm of the song without being too splish splashy, we wanted to do that. And then I don't know, it's like, this is what's so fun for me about songwriting. This is why I wanted to include this song in it, because I think it's really playful and there's the ability for levity and gravity, like the whole thing of like dancing down the darkness in the shadow of, it's a ridiculous thing to say. And you're doing it over this, it's like a total dance thing. It sounds like a dance song, you know, in the middle. And you're talking about dancing past the apocalypse, which reminded me of a friend of mine, an Austin band called Till We're Blue or Destroy. He used to always say dancing down the darkness all the time. And I love that saying. It really reminds me of people partying too much and being in over their heads and this space, you know. So it was just kind of fun to do that, you know. It sets up just a playful mood.
Well, and then to get out of that you end with this, just let's run up the scale a couple times to get to the solo here.
Yeah. Brian May.
Yeah, yeah. If you'd put two more harmonized guitars over it, that would be Brian May, exactly, I guess.
That's true, yeah. I didn't quite go to it's Brian Maybe. It's not quite Brian May.
I thought that was very cool to end the whole song with that same, the beginning of the bridge there, that we're actually playing a little bit of the bridge. It's not like it's reaching apocalyptic proportions at the end. Like, there was definitely room. The blackbirds are continuing to fall. And this, it's, you know, playing on the fun, the dance part of this. And then I guess ending, as you said, with that image, I guess, if that's what that descending guitar thing is, of the actual falling sound effect, essentially.
When I do my songwriting workshops, one of the things I always say is like, of course, the content of the song matters, but it's kind of like gymnastics when they do the routine on the bars, right? And they have a good intro, you got to have a good outro. That's one thing I do notice. A lot of people just end a song and it's, you know, I mean, not sometimes that's super cool, but I think the way this song ends, you've just had this kind of Beach Boys part where you got that ooh, ooh thing going on. And it starts to feel like, you know, repeated chorus where you're almost losing yourself in the kind of pop mana part of it. And then at the very end, you go back to like the will she, won't she kind of thing. And that's the end of the song.
Well, let's get our second song on the table here. Really a completely different set of influences here. Strange Days, the title track from the 2017 album Strange Days. You want to say a little about it before we hear it, and then we'll talk more in depth?
You know, what I will say that's the continuum from Blackbirds to this one is that the narrative's not at all what you think it is. And that's kind of something that's probably my default way of writing. I like having a song that people think is one thing, and then I have a completely, completely different meaning behind it.
The sun, a free man of conscience, with my gun, a free will of destiny. You gotta choose. You might build an empire, but sometimes you got to lose.
Dancing.
a very old style R&B as far as I was concerned, especially the bass, those cool bass runs and just doing the guitar kind of like a second snare and check and chin. But strangely EQ drums, like that's the thing that stood out for me initially, like from the first time they're introduced with this long roll, is that it's just really dark EQ, maybe kind of to make it sound like old style 50s recorded drums or something.
Well, I did that one with two different people. I recorded that with Adrian Quesada, who's, you know, part of the Grupo, kind of a brown out, kind of the wunderkind in Austin of the kind of the Chicano dude that's, you know, it's cool because he's got a different, we have a lot of similarities and we have some different stuff. And then I finished that with a friend of mine named Jim Greer, who's in Oakland, and he is in a totally different bag. And that, this is what's so cool, again, about music is it's all music, right? And when you open up your mind and you're not worried, I mean, I guess maybe I should worry more, but from an artistic standpoint, and from just a fun standpoint of enjoying the process, it's so great to bounce around. I would say that the fundamental musical influence of this would be Black Uhuru, which is a reggae group that I used to see all the time at Liberty Lunch when I was young. And they were these three dudes, and they all looked like ghosts. They were super skinny Rasta guys, and they would just sway back and forth. And it almost looked like a cartoon when they were singing. It was very surreal. They were like my spirit guides for this song. I wanted to kind of channel that energy. I mean, obviously, I'm not a reggae dude, and that's not really my world. So the way the song came out was completely different.
Well, the actual starting point, I really like that intro. You know, it sounds like you're setting up. Let me just play the very, very beginning again. It sounds like it's going to be a riff relevant to the rest of the song in one guitar. And it's not even clear exactly how many times are we playing this? What exact time signature are we setting up here? But you're just kind of using that as effect. You were saying how important intros are. I mean, would this be something invented in the studio after the fact, or was this there right at the beginning, you know, as you were writing the song?
Well, it was a combination. There was an intro like that. But what was really interesting about this for me was the way Jim mixed it, because he mixed the record and he sent it to me. And then said, hey, what do you think? And I called him back and said, Jim, I don't even know what to think. I need to sit on this for a minute because it was so different. And what he did, you know, he's really in the hip hop world. So he just cut and pasted a bunch of crap all over the place. And the song was so different. He put like bridge chords under the verse and did all this stuff to where now I don't even know if I have a copy. I mean, I'm sure I do somewhere of the original that before he mixed it. It did have that intro, but the intro wasn't as disconnected as it is. Mm-hmm. He did that on purpose, I think, to kind of be unsettling so that when you come in with the groove with the drums, it really kind of shifts gear in a different direction.
Yeah, so it sounds like both these songs, you didn't work them up with a band and then go in, right? Are you partially working up the arrangement with a band, recording that, but still being open to things like what you described?
Blackbirds is pretty much how we played it. I mean, I had actually demoed that song a few months before, and it was pretty similar. So that one's not that different. I mean, a couple of little details, like the little intro to the bridge in Blackbirds, but Strange Days definitely evolved a lot. And that was, you know, it's my life. It's my career. I want to try to blow my own mind. You know, I can't get strung out on trying to impress other people because I'd lose my mind. So for me, it's really just about like I'll make a record and try to see if I can do anything that surprises me and that's interesting and hope that if that happens, then people will like it. So when I did Strange Days, what was really fun about it was the whole procedure was different. You know, I'm basically a rock guy that's rooted in blues and soul, and I still am kind of in that realm. I mean, that's fundamentally like, you know, when I write a song, you know, I typically have an acoustic guitar. And I start out that way with chords, right? So to do a record the way I did at this point in my career when I was almost 50 when I did that record was a really cool thing for me to just change everything up.
So let me play the chorus here. I hear the music calling deep in my brain. It's the glory and the power that you live for today. You know, on a surface level, it's not that different than some of the blues rock stuff that you'd done earlier in your career, but those heavy stylistic elements, especially that male choir that's ah-ing all over the place, that really sounds like you've got, again, I'm picturing sort of a 50, or is that Black Uhuru as well?
I mean, honestly, this is what I love about music because, yeah, I got that reaction from a lot of people like, yeah, man, you're back, you're doing, and to me, when I listen to that, all I can hear is Dr. Dre, the Chronic. It totally sounds like Dr. Dre to me. If you listen to Dr. Dre, the Chronic, and that even the drums and the sound and the synth sound, that West Coast thing that the hip-hop guys took from Funkadelic, I mean, it's really the Funkadelic sound, but everybody associates it with Dr. Dre because that him and Snoop redid it. To me, that's what I hear. And if I'm doing that and then people are like, you're back, then man, I won. I'm super happy about that because I'm just trying to, you know, again, do something cool. And just like with what we were talking about with Blackbirds, if people sing the chorus and they like the chorus and they don't listen to lyrics, that's fine. If people listen to this song and are like, oh man, you're finally getting back to your roots, great. You know, whatever makes everyone happy.
Let's get to the lyrics, but let's do a few more elements of the arrangement here. I want to play 145 in this break, which, you know, of course, it's not uncommon to have some kind of break, especially, you know, when you're talking about Dr. Dre or folks like that. But the particular choices that were made here, maybe this is, again, the mixing, this smoky sound and reverse reverb or something. Let me just play it. As a way to introduce your ooh, your evolution of what the backing vocals are doing. Yeah, just a crazy combination of stuff there. Was that, again, mixing tricks?
Yeah, I love that. I'm all about lasers and backwards shit, man. I mean, to me, I'd have that on every song from the dawn of my career. I literally remember being in the studio on my first record, and I was a really big fan of early Pink Floyd. It was kind of like the one anomaly that didn't really fit with kind of what totally fit to me because I was into psychedelic music when I made my first record. But the people that were making the recording were just like, you can't do shit like that. Like, you know, that random talking in the background or all that kind of stuff. To me, those little things are the little details that make everything three dimensional. So another thing we talk about a lot, like, I think it's unfair at this point to say that a great song has to be played on acoustic guitar. I'm saying that as somebody that writes that way, because a lot of really great songs, people use production as a songwriting technique. And it's really easy for songwriters to throw that under the bus as being like a trick, but it's no more of a trick than writing lyrics or anything else. It's just another angle of making a mood and a vibe.
Your talk of the lasers and the sound, the very first song that I wrote and recorded with a band, this is like 1985. The beginning of it was like some of the presets on the Casio CZ5000 that we're using, which were whoosh, 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 and then a laser sound, choo, 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 and then the song would start.
So, yeah. I totally, that could have been my career. The thing was, I wasn't good enough. I got a recording deal and then I had these great engineers and I was so daunted by their skills that I didn't have the benefit of making a bunch of four-track recordings. And I mean, I don't regret my path, but I kind of wish I had, because I always had the same style and the same sounds in my head that, you know, a lot of people ended up doing the things that I wanted to do. You know, it's, I mean, I'm not saying there's anything unique about that. It's common where we all as a society think that way, but I just have always loved that kind of music. I think it's really cool. And I don't know, I just like it.
Well, let's talk about the lyrics here before we move to the third one, which does have some more, at least, traditional elements. It's not, you know, it's 2004, it's not 1994, but at least it, you know, will give us a chance to talk about some of that connection to old blues and jazz and the different experiments that you had there. But, and some of the imagery here is definitely coming from that tradition, you know, a free man of conscience with my gun. But you were saying that you're using some of this as this imagery and what it traditionally connotes, the kind of music it traditionally connotes. I saw a blackbird on a wire, freedom birthed in fire. Well, you know, that's in no way a cliche, but you're saying that the actual meaning runs counter to what's on the surface here.
This song basically was inspired by a Joshua Oppenheimer documentary called The Act of Killing, which is about these Indonesian death squads that were basically, these guys were serial killers and they were government sponsored to rid the Indonesian country of, quote, communism, unquote. So these guys would kill thousands and thousands of people. And the Oppenheimer documentary talks to the guys that killed them. Like, it literally follows these guys around and they talk freely, thinking that they're being glorified as war heroes. So there's a couple of points, because I think this is an interesting dynamic to talk about in songwriting. The first thing that I was hit with was, we're all capable of evil. Like, any one of us, like, so you look at a Mussolini or a Hitler or whatever, if you, you know, I'll look at Trump and feel the same way, or you know, someone might look at Obama and feel this way. You look at these people and you go, that person is evil. That person is, you know, they've done all these terrible things. And we separate ourselves from these things, right? It's almost as if evil is a destination. And what's so cool about the documentary is it shows these people as old men with grandchildren, and they're gentle people that killed thousands of people. So that was the first thing. And I started to write the song, and I realized that writing it in kind of a hip hop style where you inhabit the narrator, which is something I'd never done. I've always written from a more of a emotional standpoint about things about love and things that are in, you know, injustice, like the way I wrote about Harlem on the first record. So this was a new thing for me to inhabit the narrative of a criminal and try to spin it with almost an empathetic nod. So the whole song is written from this guy's perspective. And a lot of the lines, a man of conscience, that is from him talking. I'm a man of conscience. He literally said a lot of these things. And I just watched this documentary like four times and kind of took notes on little parts. And then I wrote a song of a narrative making him like this gunslinger character, because that's how he envisioned himself. He was this kind of a gangster for the government, you know, freeing the world of a terrible thing and justifying all this evil. So the keep on dancing part is literally from him. He talks about, he reenacts how he would kill people with his wire. And he said, I'd like to play music and dance because it made it easier to kill people. So to me, singing the song that way and talking about it is a lot more powerful way in 2019, but in this time period to write a narrative, because everything's so politicized. If you do a thing like Dylan style or even like Springsteen style, you know, the only people that are going to listen to you are going to be the people that agree with you already. And the people that don't agree with you, they're going to be like, fuck you, I'm going to go listen to Toby Keith because he writes the kind of songs that I believe in. So I kind of like writing narratives that are political without anybody knowing what they're about. And I almost feel like I get to crawl into people's psyche and through a back door.
I've certainly thought a lot about our relation to evil in this way, just as a musical trope. You've got things like Bad to the Bone, and a good percentage of rock and roll is from the supposed attitude of someone who is breaking the rules and stuff. But we as suburbanites or whatever listening to this, you know, that's a way of just safely channeling dark impulses. You don't really think that the singer is a true degenerate, or, you know, at least even if that was the case, that's not the part that you're really identifying with. So having something that is actually about a historical real life killer in this, it's as bizarre as, just as you were describing, as finding that somebody that you know, like, yeah, I was in a war. I did these things that you could not even conceive of and that would completely fuck you up if you had to think about it too much. You think you're sympathizing with me, but for the wrong reasons, I guess.
Who really does affect culture in a way that shifts? I mean, some people might go, well, you're not even saying what you mean. I mean, how do you, you know, I just believe, to me, this is the most effective way to make a statement, is to do it in a way that people don't necessarily know. That's kind of been my, a couple of years ago, I had this idea. I've written a couple of songs and I don't know if it's going to turn in anything, where I wanted to write a thing basically about immigration without it ever being all, it would be all like small little narratives, you know, so people would never know that it was about it, but it was just trying to illustrate, like, when you put the microscope on anything, you can really tell what's good and what's wrong. And when you look at stuff and you look at it from a distance and you don't really focus on what's happening, it's really easy to abuse other people, like in this case, immigrants, right? So if you can write a song and talk about the love between two people, or talk about a family story in a way that you don't really know what it's about, I don't know, man. I just feel like maybe the inch towards progress is better than trying to hit a home run that's never going to land.
Right. I guess it's overcoming this overall, you know, it's not our culture in particular. It's the way the evil is depicted as the sinister music comes on and maybe there are actual horns involved. There should be some way. And I really felt like this in Texas, or just in general with the gun control debate or whatever, like, we need to keep guns out of the hands of bad people, but it's okay for good people to have guns. But no, that really isn't a distinction. It's your neighbor who's going to crack someday and shoot himself.
I think even beyond how we feel about individual issues, it's the willingness to look past a platitude and understand whether what you're saying is right or wrong. I mean, I forget who said this, but there was some pop culture guy, like a punk rock guy or somebody, that said the worst fascists in the world are punk rockers. And it's totally true, because that culture hangs on to these things even when it has no truth left. And it's like there's a certain point where you have to look at yourself and go, you know what? I'm wrong. And I just feels like right now, people in the West, and in particular in the United States, have a really hard time going, you know, yeah, I was wrong on that. I mean, everybody. And the inability to look past what we want to believe and soft focus to take a hard look at what's going on. And then I guess at a certain point, it just depends on who you are as a human being. You know, I'm a humanist and I care about people beyond my skin color and my bloodline. You know, I care about other people that I don't know, and I want people to be happy, and I want people to have their own choices. And so my art reflects that, you know, and if that makes me a political songwriter, then so be it. But I feel like I'm a humanist. I just want to write songs about people and try to write what I think is true.
So the narrator in here, to what extent is he self-conscious at all? Like, even just the image, nobody told me about the coming of the strange days. Are the strange days the days when he's old and not required to live in civilization and not be murdering anymore? Is that the strange days? Or,
and you really have to watch this documentary. I think it's amazing. It's hard to watch. The strange days are the awareness throughout the context of the documentary that he is a serial killer. Like, Oppenheimer doesn't press him, but you kind of start to get the sense like his veneer is cracking, because this guy's lived a lie his whole life. And he knew, like, just like any of us know, we know when we do something bad. He knew that what he was doing was wrong, but he just kept the bravado and the bluff going, and he had enough people, and he probably, you know, was dancing and drinking and partying, and he killed all those people, and then he justified it. And then, you know, when he gets quiet, the truth comes out. When you allow yourself to be quiet and you meditate, truth comes out. I believe that with everybody. I don't know that we're all necessarily willing to see it when it's in front of us, and I think that causes a lot of anxiety for a lot of people. So to me, the coming of the strange days is the unveiling of the fact that as he's reenacting all this stuff and he's trying to show his pride, he's realizing that he's a serial killer.
I guess it's not surprising. It would be very hard to reflect that in the music. It keeps this attitude throughout musically that makes it sound like he's still fronting. Even if the lyrics are pointing at something outside of that mood, it's not like you have a, maybe that's what that break is, but I don't think so. I think the break is just freaking cool, right? The break is not a unraveling. There's no part of the song where this spills into a self-realization or a breakdown of the facade to become something less cool.
The bridge, right? The break runs in the bridge, and the bridge is basically taking more of a, like if you had a camera, it's going more on a narrow focus on the actual killing of a person. So that kind of does set that up.
So is that, but it's the same progression. Let me just play a little bit of that.
They reflect in the steel of the soldier. Clean all the hands and pull the skin to.
Okay, so we're still in the same key. There's some really cool percussion in there. That was one thing I remarked to talk on. I mean, that's one of the ways that if this is becoming more vivid and narrow focused in the narrative, the arrangement is becoming even more cool, besides the oops and the, what is that? Just woodblock or cowbell or something put over top?
When Jim sent me the mix, the first mix he sent me, this one we actually had to work on a few times, which is rare for me. I normally will use a first mix or totally redo it. I don't normally like tweak, tweak, tweak. But what happened was he put the bridge under the verse, the bridge chords. So originally the verse, I think, was just over the one chord the whole time. And then when you went to the bridge, it was a bridge. It was a proper bridge. So this was the trade-off of kind of going for more of the immediate like hit of a song. You know how everything's like about an iPhone commercial now, right? And like there'll be this song and you hear it on an iPhone commercial and it's like, that's amazing. And then you listen to the song and the song's kind of mediocre, because once you get past that initial hook, it starts to repeat itself because they gave it all in the hook, which is what we live in a culture now where it's all about 15 seconds, 30 seconds, as opposed to 4 minutes or even 10 minutes for songs in like the late 60s or 70s. So that's what happened with this song. Like we traded off what I thought was the best part of the song. So then we got to what is the bridge. And now when you listen to it, it sounds like just another verse. And so I tried to mitigate that by putting the vocals, the woo, and the percussion in there to create a bit of a mood change, and stretched it as far as I possibly could.
Let's move to Abilene from Luminaria 2004. So a really nice kind of almost blue, slow, jazzy thing, you know, guitar oriented. Do you want to give a little intro to this before we play it?
to me, what this song is fundamentally, stylistically, it's a Tin Pan Alley song. I mean, it's pre-blues, pre-soul. I think of it, the chord progression is more in the realm of like Eden Abes, or, you know, not that it's as good as like a Nat King Cole song, but that's, or, you know, something in that realm that's a little bit more wide focus thematically and musically, and has a lot more harmonic movement than a typical more modern pop song.
So whereas A Thousand Blackbirds could conceivably be a guy who's just learned bar chords and is kind of experimenting which one, what order to put them in, this sounds studied. Like you were saying, the Tin Pan Alley chord progressions, they've got some subtlety to them, the chromatic movement and things. Where did this come from? How is this just a style you'd immersed yourself in listening, or?
Well, same as all the other stuff. I mean, I think you just listen to a lot of music and you put your hands on your instrument. It's kind of studied, but not like, it's pretty funny when I play this song with people that are jazz players, they're like, oh, that's a, you know, flat five diminished, you know, with the augmented blah. And I'm like, oh, okay. I just put my fingers here.
Okay.
That's one of the cool things about songwriting. Some of the voicings I got were because I didn't just automatically play a chord that was like, oh, I'll put a 13th chord in here. I mean, I was really kind of messing around on the fingerboard and utilizing some open strings. And, you know, I stumbled on some really cool chords and it created a little bit of extra tension harmonically that I think fit the song. So I always tell people that are young songwriters, you know, don't let that self-consciousness of looking dumb stop you from being ambitious. I would rather be ambitious and fall flat on my face than be timid. Like with this one, I just kind of hurtled along and made each chord work with each other. And miraculously, it all kind of worked and it cycles back through the chords and it makes sense. You know, I have a lot of other songs where I tried that and I never made it back home.
Now, was the guiding force in that because you already had this nice, simple, pure melody first? Or was it just that you're screwing around with difficult chords and what's coming at the same time over that is, well, you can't have a melody that's crazy over a chord progression that's crazy. You need to just have something that stays steady. Again, sort of what was the order, melody versus chords here?
I think I started to have an idea of what I wanted to write the song about, and it set the mood. I mean, I think that's a really important thing, is not to let it be restrictive to people. I mean, I want everybody, including myself, to feel liberated by options. But, you know, a lot of times with songwriting for me, you stumble on a thing and it's that playfulness of like in this allowing yourself the space. In other words, not being on your cell phone the whole time, like really allowing yourself the space to kind of drift in that consciousness. And then that tells you what chords to use and maybe what type of chords to use. And, you know, if you're listening to music and you got these sounds in your head and then you're allowing the space for those sounds to kind of marinate, interesting stuff's going to come out. And then you stumble around for a while and you come across stuff. So I don't think I had the melody. I think what I did, I probably started. So the very first two chords are basically one minor, five dominant. So that's a pretty, I mean, there's nothing that crazy about that.
Sure.
I think I started there probably and, oh, Abilene inside of me, and then was just kind of screwing around and coming up with chords as I was singing and working out the melody in tandem.
Right after that, I mean, it's going up chromatically up a half step for the Misunderstood and Cruel. Like right there, you've already sort of introduced the complexity.
Inside of me. Misunderstood and cruel.
I'm not like a chord hound. I mean, I do, I guess, know more than some people, but I'm a big Ella Fitzgerald fan, a big fan of that era of music. That's probably my favorite music, at least my favorite songwriting. And it's pretty much over my head, most of it, you know. These are like postdoctoral songwriters.
Yes.
These guys, Rangers, they're just all so brilliant. I think I have like a Rodgers and Hart book and then a couple others. And like, I look at them and my head starts to hurt because the chords are so sophisticated. But if you can sit there and you know the song well enough, you realize that really what it is it's very organic. And that's what makes this song so great, is they're not trying to be complex. They're using their knowledge of chords and harmony to create nuance and emotional backdrop for these singers to just fucking rule. I don't have that level of skill sets, but that's kind of what I was trying to do, is the melody is pretty simple. And then the way the chords sit really sets up the tone of the song, which again is a song that's not necessarily what people might think it is.
Of course, a lot of the dreamy aspect, even after you've worked out your initial guitar part, is adding the steel. There's no keyboard, right? It's just effects on the steel guitar and on your guitar on the slide.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything else on that song.
It seemed like there was some octaving of your guitar sometimes, or I was just hearing something like extra wash in one speaker, like during the guitar solo. In fact, let's play a little of that. Yeah, there's just so many overtones going on in there.
There's a Leslie guitar that's playing a counterpoint, kind of.
Okay.
You know, that's Paul Brainerd on the pedal steel. And I mean, there's a lot of people doing that now, but Paul was one of the first people that I knew of that was approaching the pedal steel from more of an atmospheric standpoint. Obviously, American Music Club was probably the first modern band that I know of, but It's such a great instrument. And again, the choice of instrumentation is such a cool thing to do in a song that can create other backdrops to make you feel something. That steel, I think, is a really emotional instrument in that song.
Yeah, definitely. And the rhythm section is so low profile in here. You know, I guess it's just a reflection of the way the things were recorded back then. When you're talking about Ella Fitzgerald stuff, you know, you've got very understated bass and drums. Actually, I didn't notice, was this upright bass? Was this electric? I didn't really focus on that.
It is upright.
Okay. Well, you were saying this means something different than what, so it's songs about cities. This isn't one of those Texan things. This is why, even though, you know, this was clearly a leap for you from your early stuff, it's still traditional and rooted and has that. I can't tell you how many times in Texas I would hear songs about Texas or about cities in Texas or something. It's some fascination with the landscape that, as a more itinerant soul, somewhat escapes me.
So I started writing the song on my way to play a show in Abilene, right? So I'm driving out, and one of the things that's interesting about living in Austin, I don't live there anymore, but that's where I grew up, and I still tour out of Austin, is you leave Austin and you're basically kind of in this wasteland for the most part in any direction. I mean, like literally, like there's just nothing there.
And oh, yeah.
So you drive out through like this open wilderness. And so I had gotten a reputation as a guitar hero and people wanted me to be this Stevie Ray Vaughan character. And that created a lot of friction in my life and my career. At this point, when I'm writing this song, I'm driving out to Abilene, Texas, which is a very conservative town, pretty blue collar. And I'm terrified to play the show because I'm going to go play my acoustic show and I'm going to play a bunch of my kind of newer, folkier material where basically I would get called, what the fuck's wrong with you fucking liberal, you know, all the crap I heard for a number of years. And I was freaking out.
For playing a song like this?
No, for just playing, you know, non kind of blues rock stuff. And kind of the, you know, material that I started kind of evolving into around my second and third records, people just didn't understand it. And there was just an interesting time where there was this weird start of this new conservative movement that's now in full throttle in the United States. And I mean, I know that's always been there, but I feel like it was a shift in consciousness where there was this like anger towards liberal, you know, media and liberal people and like, oh, you're better than us and you're talking. It's a really weird energy because I'd always had a really good relationship with small towns. And I always felt like the thing I loved about playing small towns is they felt open in the old days to me. They felt like you could roll in. And like, if you had a good rock and roll band and you put on a good show, they would love it. And they weren't so critical the way you would get in New York and Chicago, where it's like, oh, we know everything. We've seen everything. It was super cool in all bands. I mean, I don't care how cool or whatever your band was, all bands would have like the great show in Fresno or this one town. It wouldn't make sense because you just showed up and you put on a good show and the people, it was a small town and then you were big in that town, right? So something changed. That happened around the same time that I was going through some material that I was maybe a bit artier than my first record. So that was the start of the song and I was fearful about it. So then I shifted my fear into a narrative and I became a gay man, I guess, in the narrative. And to me, it was the whole song's written from the perspective of a gay man who's in love with another man. And the guy's in the closet. I mean, they're both in the closet, but the other guy's totally in the closet. And so he will not ever admit their love. And so the whole thing to me, and this is why I don't normally talk about the songs to this degree, but I'm a huge music fan, like probably you are and like a lot of the people you interview. And so I write my songs are all like little psychic breadcrumbs. I'm always putting little things out there. Most people aren't ever going to notice it, but you know, every now and again, somebody's going to follow the breadcrumbs to what I'm actually really talking about. And in this case, I'm referencing the song Strange Fruit for a reason, because it's about the lynching of a black man. And I use that to connect it to the killing of Matthew Shepard, who was the gay guy that was killed and hung up on a fence in Wyoming. You left me hanging there like some strange fruit from a tree. So that's what the song, that's kind of the gist of the tune, is the fear of being a gay man and being killed for being in love with somebody. I thought that was a pretty potent narrative to write a song about.
And again, now that you're saying it, I was going to say if it were a little more literal, but it's pretty damn literal.
It is literal. That one's right. There's not, it's right there for people.
And there's something about the dreamlike, this is of course just common to that kind of vocal jazz, where it can be extremely sad, but it's got a warm blanket to throw over you. So it's a way of treating the sadness and not just expressing it, right? This is not a offensive to listen to song in a way that contemplating that act is offensive and upsetting. This is not an upsetting song.
That's the whole point. Like, you can leave Abilene and go to San Francisco and be amongst a bunch of other people that have the same views of life that you have, but you're never going to leave where you come from. You will always be from where you're from. And I guess that's the gist of the song. It is what it is, you know, Abilene, too many sunny skies. It's where you're from, and you can leave all those things behind. But I don't know, man, I guess that would be the other part of the narrative, is that you can't really run away. You know, you can leave and you can go find things, but ultimately making peace with the world that you come from is a really important part of being happy and being all right.
Yeah, I guess the word wistful is what I'm looking at. A lot can be packed into that in terms of your very mixed emotions about the past. It's not simply a sadness. It's an acceptance and that's the tragedy we have to live through. That's just it.
Maybe a little bit of pride, you know, a gentle pride.
Sure.
I mean, we all want to be from something cool. There's a really, really beautiful adage that I say all the time. It's one of my favorite things. It's from Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and Kafka was being translated, and The Metamorphosis was being translated into Spanish, and Marquez has his writing read by Kafka, and Kafka says it's terrible. And Marquez is crestfallen because he really was excited to impress Kafka and had written thinking that Kafka was going to dig it because it was like his style. And Kafka basically said, "Your writing is like a bad echo of me. Why would I want to read this?" You know. And then he says, "The moment that you find the beauty in the mundane around you is the moment you become an artist. And the moment you find magic around you and these little things that you think are not that special, that nobody would ever care about, that's when you really discover your voice." And I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, when you're from a town and you're from a place and you think it's just a total piece of shit and, you know, you have no pride, I mean, I don't know. I think you feel a little bit lost. I think it's important to find magic in the place that you come from.
Well, let's shift to our final song. We're just going to introduce and say goodbye here. The one I had picked, because we hadn't covered this era exactly, was from the 2011 album El Sonido Nuevo. And the song was Sad Affairs. You know, we were looking for a closing. This is the closing of that album. I just really like the feel of this. Do you want to say a little about where you were at this point in this song in particular?
That was me taking a very deep nod to one of my favorite songs ever written, which is Holocaust by, it's Big Star, but it's Alex Chilton.
Yes, I didn't want to say that it sounded like you were slightly ripping that off, but like that completely occurred to me.
Yeah, but mine's way more of a pop song. I mean, it's so deeply bleak. It's like, you know.
That is exactly what I was talking about in terms of if you'd had On Strange Days, the narrator realizing that he's actually cracking up and, you know, the horrible truth of his existence, you would get something like the things that happen in Holocaust and really that whole album where it's just these eruptions of sonic dissonance to symbolize or reflect his breakdown or theatricized breakdown, I guess.
I think I love that record for that point. I mean, I know, like, talking to Jody and other people close to it, that it was a really terrible time and I wouldn't want to live through that with him. But as a person, seeing somebody write that openly about bitterness and sadness is really, in a strange way, kind of inspiring, because it's a part of our life. And mine is way more of a lightweight version than his. His is just brutal. I mean, the term Holocaust for the title of a song. I mean, that record in particular is one of my favorite records of all time and has been for a lot of my life and definitely shaped a lot of my writing. So that's probably the most obvious nod that I've ever done in my life to another artist in another song.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to immerse myself in your work. You know, I wasn't familiar with the stuff past the first couple albums, past what I was more or less firsthand witness to in Austin, and just had no idea of how many styles you'd gone through since then and how much I would like the newer style. It seems like every album was better than the last, as far as I was, you know, trying to go through this chronologically.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been an interesting career because, you know, like, probably similar to, in a different way, to people like John and Ken, but even, you know, because of the nature of how I came out, a lot of the stuff that I've done, it's really, I want everybody to just dig it because they dig it. But I do realize that we live in a very, very cultural, people have their feeding lanes and you know, I'm a little bit idealistic in the way I look at it, but, you know, I just keep trying to make the coolest records I can and trust that the audience is going to dig them, you know, that's all you can do, right?
Well, and at least the internet makes it so easy. You know, I saw posters for Black Uhuru for my entire undergrad career. I never saw them because I just, you know, I had no way of even knowing what this was going to be. And it, yeah, it's the same with a lot of my time in Austin there. Like, I know I saw at least one of your shows, but a lot of those legends that were just constantly mentioned were just, I didn't even bother to go to those shows because, like, I knew that wasn't exactly my scene. And so having to leave the house as opposed to, you could just Google Black Uhuru. You can hear them right now. Like, I know it still might be hard to get people to, you know, work their way through your catalog, but at least they have the capacity to do so.
That is a cool thing about the internet, is that people have access to different information. The tricky thing is everyone is so busy all the time that really taking the time to, like, for anybody, whether it's me or you or anyone else, to really get to the meat of what somebody's about. You know, there's like a, one of the things that's been interesting to watch is finally, like, places like Spotify and stuff are allowing artists a little bit more control about how they're represented on the greater internet. Because, you know, it's like, if all that you have is something you did 30 years ago, and that's what every single person's going to do, then it really impedes your ability to even craft a contemporary fan base with where you're at. So it is an interesting thing that I think is being corrected a little bit, where artists have a little bit more control over their messaging so that they can hopefully send out the missives, you know, get people that are in line with what they're really about, you know?
All right. Well, here's Sad Affair, El Sonido Nuevo. Check it out, folks. Thanks again.
Thanks, Mark.
It's a lowland cue, your tired point of view. She won't stop talking. The moment when you quit, when you were sick of it, justify your crimes as city calls. You hold a high regard for your house of cards. It's such a sad affair. Such a sad affair when you're sitting there. All your philosophies make it so hard to see. We got off track. 'Cause from your point of view, life's been so hard on you. Been fighting just to save us this attack. Now there's no one else, you've only got yourself. Such a sad affair. Such a sad affair when you're sitting there. Put yourself together, mend your tiny cracks. A little such a sad affair. Such a sad affair when you're sitting around. All these small distractions fade. You're such a sad affair when you're sitting there.
Thanks so much to Ian and to Lincoln Barr, who connected me with him. To learn more about Ian's music, please see ianmore.com. I have to say, this is one of the interviews I most enjoyed listening to again while editing. Ian is just a very insightful guy. And if you do want that Texan blues rock guitar, check him out on YouTube. He really can still do that very, very well. Now, some news about the podcast. You can, of course, get all of my episodes at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I'm sure many of you get these at partiallyexaminedlife.com. Maybe you're even hearing this on the Partially Examined Life feed, but I really want to encourage anyone who likes this podcast to go instead to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Make a small per episode pledge there, $1 is fine, and install in your favorite podcast app the personalized podcast feed URL that appears when you are logged into Patreon looking at this podcast. And that'll do three things. First, there's a bunch of bonus footage for at least a dozen episodes that I've done over the years here with additional songs, so that's worth it by itself. Second, as those of you on the public feed have heard, I'm now including commercials, and that's going to be the way it is going forward. If you get the version from the Patreon site, you will never have to hear any of those commercials, so keep your ears free of that pollution. Now, the third thing, the most important thing, is if I have enough evident support from supporters in that way, then I will for sure keep doing these interviews. I have now recorded my 100th interview, and that was the point at which I felt like if this was not paying for itself, I was maybe going to scale back. And sure enough, I have nothing scheduled right now. I have a few folks I've made commitments to interview, but I'm leaving the calendar wide open until what I've released catches up with what I've already recorded, or until opportunities are presented to me that are just too wonderful to pass up. There's certainly many musicians that fall in that category. But that is, of course, not the situation I'd like to be in, where I'm only doing it now and again if something really wonderful comes along. I know, and you should know by now if you've been listening to this podcast, how many really freaking amazing musicians are out there, great songwriters that I would love the excuse to delve into and share with you all. But I need to know that you're with me. So go again, patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Since it's a per episode pledge, if I don't release anymore, you don't pay anything else. And of course, you can also help by sharing the interviews through social media. You can follow me on Facebook or Twitter. And whether or not this is the home stretch of the podcast or merely the fourth of a dozen plus years of doing this, I want to thank you all for your interest in this podcast and in these musicians. I hope they're adding some joy to your life, some inspiration. By all means, keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.